Welcome to Southeast Native Radio. Tonight our guest is Fred Paul of Seattle. Fred is an attorney. He was admitted to practice law in Alaska, in the Territory of Alaska, in 1940. He served as Assistant Attorney General for the territorial government in 1943 to 1945. He drafted the Anti-Discrimination Bill in 1945. He served as a lawyer for the Central Council of Tlingit Haida Indians from 1946 to 1956. He served as a lawyer on the Tihitan case, which we'll talk about a little later, in 1955 before the U.S. Supreme Court. And as far as recent history is concerned, out of 8,000 lawyers in the King County Bar, he received the Distinguished Lawyer of the Year Award in 1985 in King County, Seattle, in the state of Washington. Welcome to our little program, Fred.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy.
I'd like to start tonight, since this topic covers a whole variety of issues, on the book that you've been working on for the last 10 years or so, the history of Indian civil rights or Native civil rights in Alaska. What's the title of the book?
The title of the book is, quote, "Then Fight for It," unquote. The quotation marks are a part of the title because it relates to an event in the book. It's going to be published by the Howe Brothers of Salt Lake City, January, February of next year.
I'm sure a lot of the early part of the book was inspired by your father and your mother, William and Francis Paul, and your grandmother, Tilly Paul.
I suppose initially my inspiration was my grandmother, Tilly Paul Timory. We don't know when Grandma was born, but we sort of reckon it was 1864. I knew her well. She died in 1955 when I was 41. She was widowed early with three boys. Sam, who went to Carlisle and never came back, lived in New York City. And then my father is next, and Uncle Louie, mm-hmm. both of whom did come back. Growing up in Ketchikan, where I spent most of my younger years, I saw a great deal of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember one story that sort of inspired me. I worked in a drugstore during high school, and I was a delivery boy. And I take medicine out to a lady that I knew as Susie. She was an Athabascan from the interior country around Fairbanks. She had lived as a common law wife of a prominent citizen in Ketchikan. The husband, the prominent citizen, eventually moved to Ketchikan and married again. He had a big, beautiful house up on the hill. Susie had been his common law wife in the interior, and so she followed him. Well, anyway, I learned early on that once upon a time, common law marriages were legal.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1917, the pressure of the pioneers was such that, you know, some of the guys up there made a stake. And if a common law wife actually is a wife, and under the common law, such a wife is a wife, she would be entitled to a good deal of his property rights. Well, the pioneers are extolled as great people, but after all, they're human too. They didn't want to share. So they prevailed upon the 1917 legislature to abolish common law marriages. I'm not sure it meant very much for the most part, because what Native wife would have the internal strength to get some lawyer to sue for her rightful share of her husband's property? But in any event, Susie was one of those. And my heart went out to her.
Mm-hmm.
Your question was inspiration about my grandmother and my father and mother. Mother taught school in Ketchikan and the Indian school. In those days, of course, we had segregated schools. This was 1929, while I was still in high school. What happened there was, there was a girl, she was in the sixth grade at opening of the school. Well, the second day, Superintendent Anthony E. Carnes, known as Tony, told Nettie's daughter that she had to go to the Indian school. Well, Nettie had a good deal of grit to her, so she came running to my father, and before a lawsuit was started, Dad believed in trying to solve a problem by some administrative solution rather than a big lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
So he met with Tony Carnes, and then he met with the school board. The school board was composed of three members, two of whom I remember. Dr. R.V. Ellis, a very respected medical doctor in Ketchikan, and Mrs. Axel Carlson. Mrs. Axel Carlson had two sons in high school, and I knew them both, Kenneth and Weldon. Anyway, they had a bunch of meetings, and finally Mrs. Carlson lost her cool, and she shouted at my father, "Unless you quit this business, we're going to start a race war that will begin at the top." What she was referring to was that she was going to have my father's children kicked out of the public school and make us go to the Indian school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, Dad couldn't take that lying down, so he sued. And the case went its normal course, you know, a few weeks passed, and we had some hearings, and the excuse that the school system had was that there was no room in the sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
So they made an inspection of the room and inspected the school records, and sure enough, there was not an empty seat in the sixth grade. But you looked around on the floor, you know, and there were screw holes where some desks had been removed. Well, about that time, a new family moved into Ketchikan, and they had a child in the sixth grade. Lo and behold, there was room for that youngster. Well, when that came out in the trial, that was the end of the lawsuit. But actually, that case had great significance because it was where a judge ordered a school system to admit an Indian child. And that was the beginning of the segregated school system. The Indian Bureau of Indian Affairs, in those days it was the Bureau of Education, but it's the same thing. Their school system was very, very deficient. They would hire somebody from the stateside, and they'd go to a village, and maybe they'd hold school, and they wouldn't there, maybe they wouldn't. Or if they did hold school, it might start at 10 o'clock or whatever the teacher showed up. Maybe he wouldn't show up at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you have to superimpose that upon the Indian culture. In the spring, the fish run. And, of course, the families go to the fish camp. And in the fall, there's hunting. And they would go to their hunting cabins. So, basically, the, shall I say, the Bureau of Indian Affairs schools were really not much.
What about the voting rights issue? This 1924 statute that bestowed citizenship on American Indians and Alaska Natives.
The controversy really began about 1915. The territorial legislature Well, first of all, everybody assumed in the territory of Alaska that natives were not citizens,
mm-hmm.
Indians, whatever. And, for example, the discoverers of the Chichagov Gold Mining Company, and as far as I know, they took $97 million out of that mine. In any event, it was discovered by four natives. Ralph Young was one of the prominent ones, and I forget the other three, though I have it in my records, discovered it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course they couldn't, because they were Indians, file a mining claim. This is, what, call it 1905.
Mm-hmm.
Close enough. So they went to the Reverend George J. Beck, who was a teacher at the Sitka Training School, but eventually became the Sheldon Jackson School. And George J. Beck said, he was a true Christian, he said, yes, I will help you. I will file for the mining claim, but I want no part of the ownership. It's your mine. If I take a part of the ownership, it will interfere with my chosen destiny on earth of being the exponent of Jesus Christ. They did get somebody else, a guy by the name of De Groot at Sitka, to help him with selling it. And they did sell the mine for, I think, Ralph Young's share was $25,000 before it was full development.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, the point being that Indians couldn't file for mining claims because they were not citizens. Well, in 1915, the territorial legislature passed a bill saying that Indians can become citizens, providing they do certain requirements. The requirements being that they had to get a petition signed by some white people, therefore citizens, and then they would file this petition with the United States District Court, and then they would take an examination to be administered by some school teachers. Then, if they passed, then the results of the examination would be transmitted to the United States District Judge. He, in turn, would post a notice, and it had to be supported by the endorsement of two or three more white people, that they were really wonderful Indians and deserved to be citizens.
Did they have to prove civilization, that they were civilized?
That really came up later. I'll get to that in a moment. But my Uncle Louis, this is before my father came back. My father came back to Alaska in 1920. In the 1919 AME convention, my Uncle Louis gave a speech that the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution, in its first section, says that anybody born in the United States is a citizen. Funny thing, you know, if an immigrant came over here and had his children born here, the children were citizens. But if Indians were born here, they were not. Or at least that was the accepted idea.
You're listening to Southeast Native Radio. This evening, Fred Paul is discussing Southeast Native civil rights struggles in the first part of this century.
So there was a big controversy there at the AMB Convention in 1919, and the proceedings of the convention were recorded in the Sheldon Jackson's publication called The Verstovian. Sheldon Jackson at one time was quite militant, the school was quite militant, and I think it was Dr. Condit who made the report. Wonderful man. When my father came back in 1920, by then he was admitted to the bar up here in December of 1920. He believed that Indians were citizens automatically. So at the ANB conventions, Dad would give lectures on how to vote. So in 1922, my tribal uncle, a chap by the name of Charlie Jones, went up to vote. He was later to become Sheikhs of Wrangell, chairman of the council of the Indian tribes there. Anyway, he went up to vote and got turned down. As he was coming back, I bumped into my grandmother. And Grandma saw him and said in Tlingit, what's the matter, Kadinaik? That was his Indian name. I went up to vote, and they won't let me vote, he said, in Tlingit. Oh, okay, she said. Come with me. So back they went. Well, the election judges were Ole Gunnarsson, who was single, and Johnny, what was his last name? His family owned the shrimp cannery there at Wrangell. Johnny
Ingstrom?
No. Thomas. What was his first name? I forget. Both Thomas and Neil. Neil. Is that right? Neil. J.G. Neil. Anyway, both of them had Indian wives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rather ironic that they were telling Charlie Jones, my travel uncle, you can't vote because, in effect, they were saying their wives couldn't vote. But that's what they said, all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the magic word in such a situation is challenge. So Grandma says Charlie Jones challenges your decision, which means that the election board has to swear the applicant, and he has to swear that he is a citizen, and therefore he votes. So that's what happened. Charlie Jones swore that he was a citizen and voted.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty soon the U.S. attorney, a guy by the name of Arthur G. Shoup, brought the three election board judges before the grand jury in Ketchikan. And the grand jury indicted Charlie for voting, being a non-citizen, and for perjury, for swearing that he was a citizen when in fact he wasn't, and against Grandma for aiding and abetting. 1922. That was spring of 23. So they were arrested. Cute little story. The deputy U.S. Marshal at Wrangell was a guy by the name of Campbell. And Dad was able to get to Ketchikan before his mother and his travel uncle arrived. And so as they came off the steamer, Campbell says to Dad, "Thank heavens you were here. I didn't know what to do with your mother. Your grandma had spent all her life working for the church and most esteemed citizen, and they were going to put her in jail." But the judge said $2,000 bail, and the Presbyterian minister at Ketchikan, Fred Faulkner, and A.J. Otto Inman. Many people may know the Inman boys at Ketchikan. Anyway, they posted the bail, and so Grandma didn't have to go to jail. And I guess I don't think she was handcuffed, but modernly they would have had to been. Well, in due course, the trial was had in the spring of 1923. Bearing in mind the Citizenship Act is 1924.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the rule, the orthodox rules as of then were bottomed on what is known as the Dawes Act, 1887. And the Dawes Act said that if Indians have abandoned their Indian ways of life and adopted the white man's ways of life, that they could become citizens, or would be automatically citizens. In the course of the trial, Dad put in the 14th Amendment argument, and the district judge turned that down. But he did rule that the Territorial Act of 1915 was unconstitutional, so that was thrown out the window. But the trial itself is interesting because under the Dawes Act, the issue is, has Charlie Jones abandoned his Indian ways of life and become, shall we say, civilized? Well, how do you prove that you've abandoned an inferior culture, so to speak? At least that would be the orthodox view. And adopted the white man's ways. There's no textbooks on it. So Dad devised his own system. Does he live in a house, a wood house? Does he use knives and forks? Do his children go to school? Does he give to charity? Well, Charlie actually had paid town taxes and kept his receipts since 1907. In the charitable situation, he gave to the Red Cross, a gift to the Red Cross for me, a gift for my wife, a gift for my son, Richard, who had been paralyzed for many years and lived basically in his bed. I give for Captain Wilson. Now, Captain Wilson was his dog. And it's a tradition among the Tlingit, at least, that you name your pets after favorite people. And Captain Wilson, the original, was the superintendent of the local sawmill. So my travel uncle had this little bear dog, actually used in bear hunting, grizzlies, as well as black bear, but frequently grizzlies. Charlie had named his little bear dog for Captain Wilson. Well, the jury came in with a verdict of not guilty, and so the indictment against my grandmother was dismissed, and she was never tried. And Arthur Shoup, the U.S. attorney, said to my father privately, he says, "I will never bring another case like this again in my life." All of that is a true story. I tell these stories in my book as part of the history of Alaska, part of the history of the discrimination. Now, your basic question was citizenship. With the Indians were beginning to vote, I'm talking about Southeast now, in the 1922 election, but not very many. Well, with Grandma's and Charlie Jones's acquittal, in the 1924, there was quite a movement, and of course the Alaska Native Brotherhood was in full swing then. And Dad was running for the legislature in the 24 election. The white people became alarmed. And actually there were over 1,000 votes by natives in the 1924 election. But beginning in 1923, the so-called intelligentsia of Alaska, southeast at least, formed what is known as the White Men's Party, quote-unquote. And they had political advertisements, and they had legislative candidates for the territorial legislature and the territorial senate. And their theme was that we can't let the natives, the Indians, be our bosses. These advertisements, and I have exact duplicates of the advertising in the Alaska Daily Empire. The Empire was then owned by John Troy, later to become governor. Anyway, these are quarter-page ads, and the language in these ads are pretty severe. Would you like to have your children go to the public schools with these dirty Indian children and get all kinds of diseases? Or do you want the petty juries to be composed of Indians who are going to judge your guilt or innocence of an alleged crime? Is that what you want? If you don't want that, vote for the white man's party. very graphic. Mm-hmm. Very, very graphic. The Indian vote was primarily in the villages. And, of course, in the voting, the vote counting, the urban communities, Ketchikan and Juneau primarily, Wrangell, Petersburg, Stony Camp, and Skagway, a little bit of Sitka, the vote came in early. And the White Men's Party was way, way ahead. Well, as the votes came in from Yakutat or Cape or Kluwak, there was a village next to Kluwak called Bayview, Kassan, Metcalfe. As the votes came in, the White Men's Party's majority was dwindling, and finally they lost. Well, what in the world are they going to do with this? And my father was the target. He in the ads, well, he was always named. The next assault was to have a literacy test. But that was the legislature then, 1925. And the literacy test was endorsed by all the chambers of commerce. It was going to pass. So how in the world are we going to get Dad set himself on the road? We're going to manage this. So he prevailed on enough of his supporters in the legislature to put in an amendment. You had to have pass a literacy test, except if you had already voted, you didn't have to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it didn't really mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it passed, and one of our great concerns initially with Tony Diamond was he was one of the supporters of the literacy test. Now, I have a great admiration for Tony, and I would like to later on tell how Tony Diamond was a big friend of mine. But the White Men Party wasn't through yet. They went to Congress, and they introduced a literacy test bill relating to the territory of Alaska there, which meant that Dad had to go back to Washington and prevail upon some friendly congressmen to make another amendment, except as to those who had already voted. It did pass, but of course it had no teeth.
You've been listening to Southeast Native Radio. Tonight's program is part of a series where Fred Paul recounts the struggle for Native civil rights in Southeast Alaska. Next week, part two in this series. Tonight's program was produced in the studios of KTOO-FM, Juneau.